accession number 18089, Reel 4.
I just mentioned that we occasionally did demonstration scrambles. There were two reasons for this. The most obvious was, of course, to interest the public, to give them value for money. After all, we were costing the country, I suppose, quite a lot of money. We wanted to demonstrate to the taxpayer that this was indeed a credible deterrent. They were getting value for money. We wanted to show them the spectacle. We also wanted, of course, to demonstrate to our potential enemies that we had this capability. And we know for a fact that members of the various Warsaw Pact embassies were amongst the crowds. They often used to preposition alongside the airfield when we were routine training to monitor our activities. And they certainly got the message that this wasn't an idle boast. We certainly could get those four aircraft airborne within the presumed warning time. One such demonstration, I recall, was given to Princess Margaret following the presentation of a squadron standard. And that event had originally been scheduled to take place when the squadron was based at Finningley. That's in Yorkshire. But it was postponed when Princess Margaret married Lord Snowden. A further postponement followed when she became pregnant. And then she eventually agreed to come and present the standard in the middle of 1962, by which time the squadron had indeed relocated to Waddington. But since protocol would not permit a change to a venue for which a royal invitation had been extended, the entire squadron had to move back to Yorkshire for the occasion and present the fiction that we had never moved away. That was somewhat amusing. And expensive, I suppose. Back to the more serious stuff. My most sobering experience came in October of 1962, when a Soviet freighter believed to be carrying nuclear missiles to Cuba was ordered to turn back in the face of President Kennedy's naval blockade. Now, that routine QRA posture, which I mentioned, of being able to get airborne within 50 minutes, had been tightened to cockpit readiness, readiness 05, whilst the numbers on alert had been considerably strengthened. At the critical time, my crew was strapped in, poised to start engines with a nuclear weapon loaded in our bomb bay. Had we been scrambled, we were to fly east into the unknown. What is pretty certain, I suppose, is that the face of Lincolnshire would have been unrecognisable had we been fortunate enough to return. And I can honestly say that nobody was more relieved when that freighter did do an about turn than those members who had been sitting in cockpits like myself and my colleagues on the squadron. Great relief.
This is the point you referred to earlier on, that contrary to popular belief, the sorties were planned as a return trip. And the question is, what do you return to? Can you even land?
Yes, and perhaps I can elaborate on that just a little. They were not one-way suicide missions, I think was the phrase I perhaps used. They weren't one-way trips. We didn't necessarily return to our takeoff base. There were a number of countries within the NATO alliance which perhaps could have accepted aircraft at the conclusion of the mission. That's related a sobering experience, and I don't think they come any more sober than that. There are also some amusing incidents. Crews on QRA were frequently brought to higher readiness states when they were required to start engines and practice simulated scrambles, usually in the middle of the night. They would rush to the aircraft, unlock the entrance door, climb up the ladder, and exercise the procedures up to the point of takeoff, as we mentioned just now, with engine start being initiated externally by the technicians using their sim start trolley. But on one occasion, I well recall, to my embarrassment, water had frozen around the door, which was centrally located on the underside of the fuselage. water had frozen around the little keyhole. I literally was frozen out. I couldn't get the key in. I couldn't open the door. So I didn't get up the ladder. I didn't get into the cockpit. And so we were literally left standing whilst the other aircraft moved off, the engines having decayed in the process. On another occasion, in the confusion in the middle of the night, there shouldn't have been confusion because they were well-rehearsed drills, somebody else's navigator climbed into my aircraft by mistake, leaving his own crew not only wondering where he might be, but of course also quite unable to perform its task had it actually got airborne, had it scrambled for real. My main problem, had we got airborne with one extra navigator, would have been to apportion the inadequate rations and, of course, the survival kit. But happily, that was only an exercise, and I think the embarrassment was covered locally. I believe there are many such similar incidents.
Was each navigator then separately briefed? So the wrong navigator would have taken you to the wrong target, or what?
No, at that time, perhaps I should make myself clear, at that time, a period of normal tension, shall we call it, there were three aircraft at Waddington on QRA, one from each of the three squadrons then resident there on A dispersal. And it was the old H-shaped dispersal, so one, two, three Vulcans and perhaps a spare. Three of them will be loaded. Crew A knew that was its aircraft, Crew B knew it was that aircraft, and Crew C knew it was that his aircraft was there. This navigator simply confused the location of his aircraft. My crew went to our designated aircraft. This chap just went to the wrong one. And in the heat of the moment, the door was shut behind him, and we got on with the exercise. And I suppose the other crew, deficient of one navigator, did the same thing, and hoped it would only be an exercise. So that was the significance of that. I was going to say, although this is rumour, that there was another somewhat more serious incident involving an over-enthusiastic Victor crew, which actually got airborne without political authority to do so. On the these exercises were termed oranges and lemons, and the lemon and the yellow was simply to start engines and then to record the time when we were ready to taxi. And the more demanding exercise was the orange, when we would start engines from on the dispersal, which I've just referred to, taxi out to the end of the runway, and then open up the throttles, simulating a takeoff, and then close the throttles and turn off. And we would take the time again for exercise purposes when we had achieved full power and were rolling. And we can only assume this Victor must have been, I say, rather too enthusiastic. He kept the power on for too long, and he got to the point where he couldn't stop within the remaining runway distance, so the safer thing to do was to take off.
Now, in these QRAs, your orders come direct from London?
I mentioned just now, from the bomber controller at High Wycombe over the tele-scramble.
Yeah. And they bypass the airfield's air traffic control system?
No, they were in parallel running to the airfield's air traffic control system and then anticipating what's going through your mind, perhaps. Clearly, if the bomber controller gave the order for an exercise scramble or for the real thing, clearly those movements had priority over everything else on and around the airfield. The runway had to be cleared, sanitised, as did the immediate airspace. And so that was why it was important for air traffic to have the same telescramble coming into the control room so that they could do just that. They could clear the circuit, clear the runway, such that we then had unfettered access and movement. Mm. Yes. I should say, of course, that the bomber controller would have required the political authority to initiate these procedures before doing so. In case there was a maverick bomber controller in the cell at High Wycombe on the end of the telescramble transmitter, there was what was called an authentication procedure. He was required to authenticate his message. We were required to validate that authentication by codes which we carried in the aircraft. If the codes didn't match up, we didn't move.
So your order came accompanied by that code?
Yes. Yes. That was the two-man political control.
And then at the other end, the High Wycombe controller, presumably he's authenticated by number 10.
He was given the authority by number 10 to signal the message, that's right. And he would know what the appropriate code for the day was, and for the time of day was. He would read that off his matrix, I presume. Then we could validate that, because we were using the same matrix.
And did the Prime Minister have the same little black box following him around like the American President did?
Passed. I don't know.
No.
I do know, as a result of one of my subsequent appointments, that there were in place procedures whereby the Prime Minister could be reached if he or she was out of London, away from the Cabinet Office, which was the nerve centre in London, and could be contacted, and certainly a sufficient time to initiate whatever procedures were necessary to match the readiness state then in force. Mm.
Anyhow, back to the Vulcan.
Well, I think I've almost come to the end of my first tour on the Vulcan. If you've got time for a little story, someone living in North America in January of 1965 would probably have watched TV coverage of Sir Winston Churchill's funeral, courtesy of the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. And there, in my view, is an epic story. The CBC chartered two Vulcans. I'm not sure if it was £9,000 each or £18,000 each, but that was the order of things. And they chartered them to provide continuous coverage using BBC video film, a technology which was then very much in its infancy. I was to lead a pair of Vulcans. We prepositioned at Heathrow. I was to take off with 1.5 hours worth of film in the can, and the second aircraft would have lifted off 90 minutes later and followed me across the Atlantic. Now, the whole operation, from our point of view, was overshadowed by the fact that the previous Vulcan to appear at Heathrow struck the ground short of the runway whilst approaching to land and crashed with 5 fatalities. And the then CNC, Sir Harry Broadhurst, was one of the 2 survivors, the other being Podge Howard. And so nobody at Heathrow were terribly interested in our venture. They didn't want to be associated with us. Nonetheless, we did complete our briefing down there, and we prepositioned, as I say, on the Friday preceding Churchill's funeral. And we parked in the southeast corner of the airfield, called the VIP pan, alongside the aircraft used by President de Gaulle, Foreign Minister Gromyko, and Vice President Hubert Humphrey. On the Saturday morning, the wind was such that traffic was taking off and landing towards the east. We were in the southeast corner. And since that would have delayed us by at least 20 minutes, the time taken to taxi down the other end and complete the climb-out procedure, all other movements were frozen into and out of Heathrow, and we scrambled against the traffic. And against all precedent, we were cleared to climb out over Southern Ireland. Aero didn't tolerate RAF combat aircraft overflying its territory at that time, apart from this one exception, which was presumably negotiated at the highest political level. Now, the reason for urgency was that the Columbia Broadcasting Service, the system rather, CBS of America, they were mounting a similar operation from Shannon using an Aer Lingus 707. And the race was on, with no expense spared, to be first across the Atlantic with this film of Churchill's funeral. At stake, of course, was the huge advertising revenue to be earned by the channel to be first on air with the programme. I won't go into the details. Suffice to say, there was a CBS spy on the ground at Heathrow who phoned Shannon to say, the Vulcan's airborne. And so there we were. The 707 was airborne some 10 minutes later, but it had a 40-minute start on us, which is almost impossible to overhaul. At the point of takeoff, we didn't know where we were going to land, because CBC, in our case, had set up a mobile station. Initially, we were told at Ottawa, then it moved it back to Montreal, then to Quebec, and ultimately, when we were airborne, we were told it had come to Halifax. To shorten our time, this was significant, it meant we could fly faster, because we had a limited payload, no flight refueling here. And in the event, I flew for 0.98 mark indicated for 4 hours in this transatlantic crossing. I landed at Halifax Shearwater, the naval base there, on ice with a 20-knot crosswind. And that was somewhat fraught, as you might imagine. In the event, CBS got on the air first because the 707 landed at Halifax International just ahead of us. But it being a function of the technology, which was poor in those days, the quality of the CBS film was poor. They turned off within a few minutes and took a feed from CBC. So CBC flooded the whole of North America. Of greater significance, perhaps, to that commercial venture, had Churchill died just 1 month later, there probably would have been no story at all, as by then the Early Bird relay satellite has been launched and the whole lot would have been bounced off this satellite. More excitement was to come on New Year's Eve of that of 1964. I was flying over Newcastle, the last day of the year, desperately trying to get another nav stage or perhaps another bomb to qualify for my classification period. One Olympus engine exploded, throwing debris into the adjacent engine, which itself then exploded and caught fire. We made our distress call. We completed the emergency drills. We nursed the aircraft back to base on two engines in time for our Hogmanay party. The only casualty, I think I can say, was our squadron boss, who was furious because, of course, he had to rework all of his flight safety statistics for that period. We were certainly a major statistic. He came out to the end of the runway to meet us when I recall his runway was totally drenched with fuel leaking through the rupture wing. We had a major fire, but we didn't know we'd had a fire because the fire warning circuit had been severed by one of the blades. The significance of this story, perhaps, is that the Vulcan was perfectly capable of flying on two engines. I mentioned before, I think, we used to practice a double-engine failure on takeoff and complete a circuit. The Vulcan would, in fact, fly on one engine, but, of course, that was just an exhibition piece. So far, I have been referring to the first generation of Vulcan, the Mark I. The Mark II was introduced in the early 60s and had re-equipped 101, my old squadron, by the time that I returned to command it in 1970. This later version had more powerful engines, a larger wing. It had modified flying controls, which ironically made it somewhat trickier to fly. You got adverse aileron drag on it. This model was developed initially to carry the Skybolt missile under strong points on the wing. It certainly carried the blue steel, which we alluded to a moment ago. And this was the model that continued in operational service until 1983. And by now, a variant of that W177 that we've touched upon was our primary nuclear weapon. But the primary navigation and bombing system was still largely unchanged. That is from the equipment we had previously had, and indeed from the equipment that the Lancasters and the Lincolns had. The old H2S radar was still essentially the same radar platform.
Did you have inertial navigation?
No, we didn't. No, not then. The only new equipment we had, I suppose, was the terrain following radar, which was introduced to optimise the low-level profile and to minimise our exposure to hostile acquisition radars at low level. Its serviceability was pretty poor in the early years. Perhaps it was rushed into service, I don't know, but its reliability was poor. And of course, as a result, the crews didn't develop confidence in the equipment. And of course, that was a downhill spiral. We had to have a concerted campaign to improve the reliability of the equipment and to build aircrew confidence to the point where we were indeed using it ultimately in those missions which we were flying at 250, 300 and even 100 feet. A very good bit of a kit, ultimately. When detached with my squadron to Malta in 1971, HMS Ark Royal, the previous one, supported by HMS Salisbury, was operating in the area. Ark was towing what was called a splash target, a sort of raft on a long piece of wire, rather like the banner target I was talking about where we were firing earlier on. And this was being strafed by its own Phantoms and Buccaneers. I was supposed to release 16 practice bombs on the rock outcrop south of Malta called Filfla, but Ark agreed that I might lob a couple on her splash target, and this I did, and in so doing became, I believe, the first and perhaps only Vulcan to bomb a moving target. Unauthorised, of course. Now, as we entered the 80s, it was recognised that the Vulcan was approaching the end of its useful life, but as we all know, events in the South Atlantic led to a rapid reappraisal, And on the 1st of May 1982, two Vulcans and 11 Victor tankers took off from Ascension Island, and Operation Black Buck was underway. One Vulcan attacked Port Stanley with 21 1,000-pound bombs, a very rerun of our training over Libya some 20 years previously, at the time completing the longest bombing mission ever attempted, all made possible by five successful in-flight refuelings and a wealth of experience accumulated over the intervening almost 30 years. And that Black Buck aircraft is now preserved for posterity at Warrington. And the rest, as they say, is history. But, of course, it's a very rich history, I submit. And I'm very privileged to have been so closely associated with it. I believe that the span of some 29 years between my first flight on the Vulcan in 1961 and one made just before I retired from the Royal Air Force, I believe that's probably unequalled.
When was that? When did you retire?
I retired in April of 1991.
1991, yeah.
Yes. And I flew the Vulcan towards the end of 1990, just before it was retired.
So you didn't do any tours on the Victor then, did you?
No, I didn't do any tours on the Victor. I can jump on a long way now. My ultimate appointment was Director General of Training in the Royal Air Force. And, of course, that gave me an entree into all of the flying training schools and into all of the operational conversion units. I very much enjoyed my flying. I took every opportunity to fly. And it was in that appointment that I did go up to Marham. I flew with the then remaining one Victor squadron and did a typical flight refueling profile. And I have one flight in the Victor. Even so, even though one flight, I think I'm one of the few people who have flown all three Vs. Not very many people did that, maybe a dozen.
Did you say you went on to become on the targeting committee?
Yes, I know from what you drew that impulse. More than that, in between my two Vulcan tours, I completed a course at Staff College, and I completed my first staff appointment in the Ministry of Defence in the Operational Requirements Division. The post was OR30B, and my remit specifically was to facilitate the development of the joint US-UK weapon systems that were then. I mentioned all of the nuclear associations I've talked about so far have been using UK nuclear weapons, and my colleague in the office looked after UK-UK systems. My first staff tour, I looked after UK-US systems, because I think it's generally known that the Americans did make available a range of nuclear weaponry to NATO for use in the tactical world, in the maritime world. And I developed, I worked up to the point of giving clearance for these systems to be used operationally. They involved the Canberra, the Shackleton maritime aircraft, the Nimrod maritime aircraft.
And the nuclear anti-submarine weapons.
In the case of the maritime ones, yeah. Yes. Mm. So that was my first work associated with the development of nuclear weapons. From that, during that appointment, I had the privilege of going down to Aldermaston to see what actually went on down there. At the conclusion of my tour as squadron commander, I worked in the Ministry of Defence again, but returned to Lincolnshire to command. I also commanded the Vulcan OCU in between time, that is the Vulcan conversion unit. I commanded RAF Scampton for a short while and RAF Waddington. Waddington now having four squadrons of nuclear bombers. The Vulcans previously based in Cyprus having been repatriated. So now I had something like 32 Vulcans, with a few spares perhaps, 255 aircrew, and some 2,000 people altogether under command, commanding the wing at Waddington. Back to Germany, back to the ministry again, from whence I was posted to Germany as a senior air staff officer, right against the grain, because it was said that you didn't go to Germany unless you'd been before. Well, I'd been very much typecast as part of the East Anglian Air Force, but I had had fighter experience, bomber experience, nuclear experience, flight refueling experience, all of which were facets employed by the then Tactical Air Force in Germany. So the then Chief of the Air Staff of the day, my old mentor, Michael Beetham, sent me to Germany where again I was able to apply some of that experience to the developing work of the British contribution to the Second Allied Tactical Air Force, where I flew again all of the then tactical fighters, Harrier, Phantom, Jaguar, so forth. But returned to the UK, completed the Royal College of Defence Studies course, another short tour in the ministry as Director of Defence Commitments for the whole of the rest of the world, which involved me in developing the airfield on... oh dear, I'm lost for a word, Falklands. Fascinating. From thence I was posted to Cranwell, to be the Commandant of Cranwell. At the end of that tour, and this is the appointment you were referring to just now, I went back to the ministry for my fifth tour there as Assistant Chief of Defence Staff for Policy and Nuclear Matters. And it was in that appointment, wearing my nuclear hat, that I had certain responsibilities then in conjunction with the Cabinet Office for both briefing the Prime Minister on her nuclear function and on developing the nuclear systems that were then in the pipeline, principal of which, of course, was the Trident system for the new generation of strategic submarines. The Polaris submarine had then taken over the strategic role from the V-Force. Interesting, isn't it, that an airman should have responsibility for the Trident program? But the fact is that appointment of Assistant Chief of Defence Staff for Policy Nuclear Matters alternated between the Royal Navy and the Royal Air Force, both of whom operated national nuclear weapons, the Polaris being a national system. The Army, of course, did operate nuclear weapons, but only again under the two key principle, because they were American-provided tactical battlefield nuclear weapons. So the Army never had any responsibility for developing its own systems. So that was a fascinating job, about which, of course, I'm not able to say a great deal, except I was involved in developing the new facilities up at in the West Scotland base for the Trident submarines, which have now, of course, come into service. It's good to see that that worked. And I'm not quite sure about the budgetary aspects, but that was the big concern. But even so, there was much criticism about the cost of preserving a national nuclear capability. The figure that used to be widely quoted was it consumed some 9% of the total defence budget in the era of the V-Force. I'm not quite sure whether that figure remains about the same. And that's all I suppose I can really say about the nuclear business.
Well, I think you've covered your life very well in 2 hours. There's a lot of detail, which is extremely useful. And thank you very much indeed.
Much of which, I have to say, wasn't on the tip of my tongue until you pulled it out.